Michael.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this presentation on the good, the bad and the ugly. This was inspired from a presentation that was given to the National Disability Insurance Scheme Division of the AAT at about this time last year. It occurred to me that having more than I thought our fair share of vexatious and querulous people in our division, well, more than humanly reasonable, I thought, other than outside the ninth circle of hell, that it may be helpful for people to hear from experience as to how to manage those sorts of litigants, their lawyers, and to deal with the sort of problems that routinely arise. Now, many of you will have had that experience anyway in the course of your careers on tribunal and even in practice, but it's helpful to try and structure these things, to put some principles behind them, and to perhaps learn a few skills that you may not have thought of before and a few tactics. But otherwise, if you're doing things right, it's also helpful to validate what you are doing so that you know that you are actually on the right track and the strategies that you've adopted are sound. In giving that presentation or organising it, I was referred to the Honourable Murray Kellam, AOKC. Murray is a former judge of the County Court of Victoria before having been appointed a judge of the Supreme Court of Victoria in 1998. Also in 1998, he was appointed as the inaugural president of the Victoria Civil and Administrative Tribunal, VCAT. In May 2007, Murray was appointed a judge of the judge of appeal in the Supreme Court of Victoria, and he retired from the Supreme Court on the 15th of June 2009. Following that, he served as a member of the Supreme Court of Samoa. He was appointed an acting judge of the Supreme Court of the ACT on 8th of March 2017. And in 2005, he had been made an Officer of the Order of Australia for his contributions to the law and for his support of disadvantaged people in Thailand and Melbourne. Murray was appointed as Chief of the Tasmanian Integrity Commission from where he served from 2010 to 2015. In July 2014, he was appointed by the Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission to conduct what was known as the Kellam Review into Victoria Police relating to the role of Nicola Gobbo, the lawyer known as Lawyer X, an informant. He holds a Bachelor of Laws and a Bachelor of Jurisprudence from Monash University and a Master of Laws from Melbourne University. And I think we're very fortunate to have him take up his time, it being 7:30 in the evening over where he is, to be able to share his experiences with us. And he's kindly agreed to have the presentation recorded so that we can watch it later at our leisure and that other members of COAT can use it as a resource. And so with great pleasure, I introduce the Honourable Murray Kellam. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Michael, and it's very pleasant to see that the Council of Australasian Tribunals is surviving, at least in Western Australia. As I told Michael a while ago, the body was created at the suggestion of the Law Reform Commission back in about 2000, and I was its inaugural president, and I'm very pleased to see how it's grown. I was very interested to speak to a number of members from all over Australia of the AAT because I was involved in the interview process for the ART, and quite a number of people from Victoria and New South Wales in particular, but also South Australia, commented on how valuable their local COAT chapters had been in terms of running various programs. In any event, very pleased to meet you all. Really what I want to discuss today is management of challenging hearings, usually challenging because they've been made challenging by various representatives, whether it's self-represented people or whether it's counsel or solicitors or sometimes government departments representing themselves. And I want to discuss the management of that and various approaches you can take. But as Michael said, I think it's appropriate to sort of try and have some analysis as to the sort of people you're having appear before you that are causing difficulties and you can categorise them, and there can be different approaches depending upon that category. But what I really want to deal with today is four separate but interrelated issues which are of concern, I know, to members, including members of all sorts of tribunals who in particular have self-represented people before them. I understand that there's a spread of tribunals represented here tonight. I've got no doubt about WACAT and the AAT, how often they have to deal with unrepresented or difficult people. And I suspect some of the other tribunals have similar problems, although Michael told me there's some people from West Australia Racing Tribunal there. They tend, when there's racing tribunal hearings in Melbourne, they tend to come with a whole lot of silks and not the ones that jockeys wear. And I think the silks can be pretty difficult too, but I don't know what your experience will be in your racing tribunal, but I'd be very happy to hear from people about the sort of issues they have. So the separate, but as I said, interrelated issues that do seem to concern members of tribunals. First of all, there's the hearing of cases where people with disadvantaged backgrounds and high complex behaviours appear, and the management of the events that can occur with those sort of people and their behaviours. Secondly, there's a category of highly emotional confrontation and misinformed applicants. So I want to talk about managing and dealing with them and removal if need be in appropriate circumstances. The issue of inexperienced lawyers, advocates and other representatives is another matter that I want to deal with briefly. And one issue that I know does concern tribunal members from time to time is fear of complaint and what to do when somebody says in the hearing they're going to complain against you. The issue of recusal, due to an unsubstantiated complaint, those sort of issues. We can have a discussion about that. I'm sure people have had some experience of that. And I hope that at the end we'll have a bit of time for questions and answers, or indeed if on the way through you want to put your hand up and say there's something you want to discuss, please feel free to do it. So I'll return to these separate issues shortly, but first I think it's important to look at some fundamental principles that are relevant to hearings. And here I'm talking about the sort of hearings that WACAT and AAT members are so often engaged with, and in particular with self-represented persons. First, I think that the fundamental principle, and the most fundamental principle, is you are in control of the hearing. It's you who determines how it's to be run, and it's you who determines how it's to be structured. And I think issues of structure are very important when you're dealing with these sort of people, making sure that they understand the structure that you intend to impose, in effect. It's you who determines the manner in which evidence is to be put before you, and it's you who, as best you can, controls the conduct of applicants and of respondents and of witnesses and those representing the parties. So what I want to say about that is that that's relevant at all times throughout the hearing is that it's you who sets the tone. The tone of the hearing, it might be disrupted by disruptive behaviour, but it's you who really controls the hearing, and your conduct can set the tone, and that tone can be a relaxed tone. It might be a tone of a firm control, but nevertheless, it's you who sets the tone. And that's particularly relevant in dealing with some of the types of self-represented persons with which we're concerned today. Now, imagine we're all familiar with occasions when, by reason of the conduct of those before you, things can start to get out of hand. I'm assuming I'm not the only person that's had the experience of that in hearings with various litigants. It's your response to what's happening before you and what's happening in your management of the hearing that can get things back on track when things do run off the rails. On the other hand, of course, we're probably all experienced with the situation that can arise where, try as you will, the hearing remains confrontational, remains highly charged. However, even in those circumstances, your calm demeanour and your own patient strategic management might well bring the hearing back on track. If you can't get it back on track, it's probably better to bring it to a halt for the time being, maybe adjourn it to another date, but we'll maybe just stand down and see if the parties can calm down and resume on that day. Secondly, although we can categorise some of the types of litigants who appear before us, in particular the very difficult dysfunctional category of litigant who's not really interested in the result but is as much interested in having the hearing and putting their viewpoint, we can categorise those people, but we still need to remember that each litigant is an individual. And although some general strategies of the nature that I want to talk about need to be adopted to deal with self-represented litigants, it would be an error to assume that the same precise strategy will work every time with every such litigant. That is, you really need to be flexible. So you need to be well organised, you need to be structured, but you need to be flexible and perhaps change your structure and your approach in the course of hearings depending upon what's happening. Third, I think it's absolutely fundamental to ensuring that hearings don't run off the rails by the establishment of good communications, particularly with an applicant, at an early stage. A good communication model will set the scene. Now, I accept that the obligation to establish good lines of communication is both institutional and personal to the sitting member. Quite clearly, the institutional obligation is to ensure that there's information on the website or otherwise as to the steps of the hearing or in the review if it's an AAT-type hearing. The provision of fact sheets is an institutional obligation. Advice as to how the parties can obtain assistance in their application, including how to obtain interpreters. These are all institutional obligations, and I know that the AAT has got a pretty good model in relation to that, and I suspect the other tribunals that you represent do. But it's very important that the institution accept its responsibility in good communication and in a simple but not too complex way. However, the member has an obligation also to ensure that the litigant's acquainted with the order of events, the process which is to take place, and what is required of the litigant in terms of the hearing. It's necessary to explain how the litigant is to provide relevant information, whether it be in writing, be it oral evidence given at the hearing, or by way of oral submission. Now, as I say, the institution has its obligations, but it's up to you to make sure that the party actually understands what information they might well have been already provided with. Many people will get documents off the institution, off the website, but they don't really understand it. And I guess we're all familiar with that. So it's up to you to establish at the start that the party does understand what the hearing's about. And that's going to involve discussions as to how the evidence will be given. You'll be explaining the difference between evidence and submission and the part each party has to play in the course of the hearing. And now it might be that this will be done before the hearing. It might be done at a directions hearing. However, at least at the start of the hearing, it's important that the hearing starts, that the following matters have been explained in plain English. First, your role and the part you'll play in the proceedings. Secondly, what you understand to be the central issues to be in the proceeding. And I think that this is just so fundamental, and it's where hearings can go wrong. The identification of the issues right at the start. Now, it obviously from time to time things could change in the course of the hearing, but if the issues are identified and the parties are put to a position, well, here's this issue, you agree, this issue, these are the issues we're going to proceed on, and this is how we're going to do it. So I can't emphasise strongly enough the identification of the issues at an early stage. And, of course, you should, once you've got the issues listed, repeat them, put them now, right now. I understand these are the issues in this hearing, and it'll save you a lot of bother later on when parties want to depart into other areas that aren't the subject of this agreement. And as I say, make it an agreement to start. You agree, these are the issues. As I say, agreement at this time may well save later bother. Thirdly, the order of events and the part that each party will play in that order. I don't think this needs to be too complicated, as you'll hopefully outline who does what and when in perhaps more detail in the course of the hearing. I'll turn to that later. Finally, at the end of the hearing, you should attempt to clarify the substance of the submissions of the litigant in person, especially in cases where, because of the garrulous or misconceived advocacy on the part of the applicant or others, the substantive issues are either ignored and given little attention. So I just wanted to, having set out that what I see as the fundamental communication strategy with all parties at the start of a hearing, I want to turn to the categories of litigants, self-represented litigants in particular, that you'll encounter in the course of your work. The first category I want to talk about is what's been called the legitimate one-off litigant in person. A great deal of legal writing has taken place in respect to the management of the category of that category of self-represented persons. And from that literature can be distilled what might be called some best practice processes. And I don't know how many of you might be familiar with the New South Wales Judicial Commission court book dealing with self-represented persons. It's a bit tied up to New South Wales processes, talking about directions, hearings and the like, but in essence it does have some fairly good sort of suggestions for the management of this particular category. First, I think it's important to recognise that self-represented persons are often well-meaning people with what, at least to them, seems to be a meritorious claim. This is probably their only experience with the AAT or other tribunal process. Justice Kairu, the president of the AAT, about to become ART, notes in a paper that he wrote a year or two ago called Managing Litigants in Person. He says that such litigants generally understand the nature of the legal issues in the case, but they tend to get confused about what's relevant. And I think you'll probably agree that this is often the case in circumstances whereby they file lengthy affidavits and submissions that deal with a multiplicity of events in narrative form. I've seen submissions that are 50 pages long, and by the time you distill it, there's probably 5 pages that are relevant to what the issue is really about. That confusion about what's relevant can often lead to difficulties when such parties give oral evidence as well as when they're making submissions. And again, this is another matter that can be at least improved. The giving of evidence by them can be improved if there's been a really good communication process at the start. These litigants, this particular category, the legitimate one-off litigant in person, are often quite reasonably stressed or upset. They have difficulties in understanding the law. They have difficulties in managing procedures, coping with evidence, and often expressing themselves as an advocate in their own cause. It should be remembered that most, if not all, litigants are anxious and can be emotional and anxious people, and sometimes they are more likely to appear hostile if they're corrected or challenged. And this is an area in which patience and understanding of this will go a long way to avoiding confrontation. For the member who's hearing the case, difficulties might arise when the represented, the respondent is legally represented. That is, you've got an unrepresented applicant and you've got a legally represented respondent. the self-represented person may feel disadvantaged and anxious about that when they think there's a power imbalance. The apparent imbalance can further impair his or her capacity to understand and participate usefully in the hearing. Obviously, the member wishes to give the self-represented person every opportunity to articulate the issues and to identify what's relevant. However, you need to, and I think you probably all understand this, you need to balance assistance to the self-represented party with the need to ensure that the hearing is conducted fairly. It depends, I think, very much on the legal representative and their capacity, their skills, their experience. Generally, reaching this balance should not be difficult if the representative for the respondent is sensible. After all, from their viewpoint, some assistance to the applicant will save time. But I do know that this particular issue has caused some problems for members in the AAT in particular. I mentioned the New South Wales Judicial Commission publication, Equity Before the Law Bench Book, and it's Section 10. As I said, it's got a detailed discussion of methods of conducting hearings with this particular category of self-represented person. And we can distribute a summary of that. I had a summary prepared a while ago, and if you're interested in that, I can do that rather than leaving you to read, which is quite a lengthy document. The key to conducting a fair hearing with this category of self-represented person really is to take the time at the start of the hearing to explain what's going to happen. And this may involve reframing the subject matter of the hearing and an explanation of the process to be followed. It's helpful, I think, at this stage to elicit some information from the litigant. And one way of doing this is to make let the litigant make a short initial statement as to what they perceive to be the issues. Now, that might end up being a bit long-winded, but it might also assist you with, again, getting them to identify the issues in the proceeding. It might also be helpful, if there are a number of topics to be covered in a hearing, to endeavour in the course of the hearing to deal with individual topics. That is, having identified what the issues are and various topics, to deal with the party on the basis, look, we'll deal with this issue. Would you tell me what you want to say about that? What do you say is the relevant evidence to that? I think you might find that identification of issues and the use of separation of issues and topics in the course of a hearing is pretty helpful. And this might involve you in asking questions of the self-represented litigant, maybe going backwards and forwards between the parties. It may be helpful at this stage to paraphrase the information which has been provided. Questions from the member addressed to the litigant, such as, what orders are you asking me to make today? A question as to the chronology of events that the litigant is relying upon might also be helpful in some circumstances. You've probably had the same experience as me that getting a useful chronology out of self-represented people is often very difficult. So your object with this particular group of litigants is to create a calm atmosphere. It's an atmosphere in which the self-represented person feels they're being listened to. In summary, if you remain courteous, if you remain patient, you remain calm and even-handed and give clear explanations of how the hearing is to proceed, the likelihood is that both parties, including the self-represented person, will respect and recognise your efforts and the hearing will not be too challenging. I know people in here today probably have had a large amount of experience with self-represented people, and I'm probably telling them many things that they already know, but the setting of the tone, I think, and the identification of issues with that type of litigants is just terribly important. I turn now to the category of self-represented persons who are usually much more difficult in management problems than the people we've been discussing so far. And that's litigants in person who have or appear to have a mental illness. First, it's important to note that all the techniques and the practices that we've discussed just now apply here. That is, at the commencement of the hearing to ascertain the issues, explain the roles of the parties, and the procedure to be adopted in the course of the hearing. These explanations need to be expressed in simple, non-legal language and may well need to be repeated with this category of litigant. The manner of explanation should endeavour to be informative rather than directory. Again, this is really a matter of tone and maybe need to be repeated throughout the hearing. I have on occasions created a simple document outlining such matters to give to the self-represented person with difficulties caused by mental illness or other apparent cognitive difficulty. This might need to be read in conjunction with the person and an opportunity given for questions to allay any misunderstanding. I think with this particular group, again, structure, a bit of time setting out a document and taking them through it. The issues can be identified in that document. I'm not talking about a long document, but something that they've got in their hands that they can talk to you about. It's another form of communication. I want to turn from these two categories of litigant, although the mental illness group sort of falls into the querulous too. They can cross the boundaries. But I want to talk about the most difficult category of self-represented litigant and one that I suspect you've come into contact with at some stage. And that's the querulous litigant in person who has no mental illness, although they may well have a serious, and usually do, have a serious personality disorder. These litigants tend to engage in serial litigation that is usually without merit. I might just ask, how many people have dealt with a person who falls into the category of the querulous litigant in person?
Yeah, most of it.
Well, you'll all know the difficulty with dealing with these people. A great deal's been written regarding this category of litigant over the last 20 years, and a few threads appear. They usually have high conflict personalities where their emotions are exaggerated. Their behaviour is repeatedly inappropriate. The inappropriate behaviour will, and it's been my experience on a couple of occasions, that inappropriate behaviour will escalate. If they feel they're not getting a fair go, it really is with these sort of people necessary to adopt appropriate management strategies. However, when appropriately managed, not always, but often, they can regulate their emotions and they can make reasonable decisions. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Dr. Grant Lester. There's been a lot of work done on these this particular category of querulous litigant through forensic care in Victoria. And Professor Mullins, Grant Lester and others have written papers. But Grant Lester is a psychiatrist who has had a lot of experience analysing and dealing with such litigants. Says that the general behaviour of such litigants can be summarised by what he calls the five V's. They're volatile, they're victimised, they're voluminous with vague communications, they have variable demands, and by that I think he means that the demands will shift during a hearing sometimes, and they are seeking vindication. They often appear legally competent, but their knowledge of the law is usually shallow, usually misdirected, and usually disorganised. As Justice Cairo observed in the paper that I referred to earlier, they tend to argue, they tend not to follow judicial directions. They are likely in the course of the hearing to accuse you of bias if they don't like the way the hearing is going or is proceeding. They can be quite aggressive, and their behaviour can amount to a contempt. I'll discuss issues of contempt a little later, but for the time being, my advice is be very reluctant to think about laying a contempt charge. I've seen several examples over the years where judges have laid contempt charges in the course of the conduct of the party, and it always ends up as an unhappy event. If the behaviour is so bad, bring the hearing to a stop. And if it amounts to contempt, well, it's a matter you should raise with the head of your tribunal, and if need be, it's a matter for the Attorney General to deal with. But really, don't touch contempt if you really can avoid it. That's not to say, however, that I'm saying don't lay a charge. That's not to point out to them that there are contempt laws and they can apply and they can be used. I wouldn't have any problem with that at the appropriate time, to warning the person that, you know, you're getting very close to that. It mightn't do much good, but at least it puts it on the table. But I repeat, don't ever lay a charge yourself. It always ends up heading into grief. So what Dr. Lester recommends in terms of the maintenance, in terms of dealing with these people, so I've talked earlier on with the other litigants about being flexible and setting out structures, but be prepared to be flexible. In respect to these people, Dr. Lester recommends the maintenance of rigorous boundaries. He argues that the querulous litigant, through his studies, proved to be responsive to hierarchy, and with these particular people, the formality of the proceedings should be maintained. He recommends that what's required is to control them through limits, maintaining formality, limiting the issues to be argued, and imposing time limits as well as other limits. Keeping firm boundaries and using normal practice and maintaining focus for yourself is important. I think a useful practice, again, is at the start to set out the hearing ground rules. Now, in terms of the querulous, whereas I've said in relation to the self-represented, you know, the ground rules need to be sort of clearly explained. But with the querulous litigant, we really want to make sure what the ground rules are, and that might include, you know, times. Cross-examination will be, you know, 30 minutes. Other things that you might need, or you should certainly with the querulous litigant discuss, emphasise that everybody is to speak politely at all times. Emphasise that there aren't to be any interruptions. Tell them to write down anything they wish to say when it's their turn. As I say, time limits. Experience does show that maintaining a structure of this nature will generally assist, but unfortunately some querulous litigants will do all they can to make life difficult. Justice Kairu noted in his paper, an additional complication is that some querulants resist the legal process, and they're not really looking for closure of the legal problem. Their condition, their personality defects puts them in a position where they perceive every setback as reinforcing their view that the system, the legal system in particular, is against them and makes them more determined to press on. If this is the situation you find yourself in, the best you can do is try and maintain some structure in the hearing and, above all, stay calm. Remember, you set the tone. And these people can be abusive. If you feel the hairs in the back of your neck rising, just say, I'm going to stand down for 5 minutes and perhaps depart with, now you need to have a think about, you know, what you're saying, et cetera. You set the tone. Other than that, other than referring to that sort of structure, in some cases with this particular category of people, it might be that you just have to spend some time, let them go. A litigant some years ago, many years ago, who was extremely difficult. And virtually everything I said created another bushfire. And in the end, I just thought, well, I'll just sit and listen. And the submissions were about the Constitution and the Masons and all sorts of stuff that was utterly irrelevant. But in the end, I thought, I've got another hour and a half to go this afternoon. We'll see if he finishes. And he just went on and on. He looked at his watch at about 4:15. I said, we'll adjourn soon. He kept going. And at 4:30, he looked at his watch and said, I've got to go. I'll miss my train. And he departed. And that was the end of it. Didn't see him again. Didn't come back the next day. Just went. So, you know, they're odd people, but that did work. I'd spent the morning, you know, unfortunately, arguing the point. No, you can't argue about the Constitution. The Constitution is not relevant to this. You know, Masons haven't got anything to do with it. You know, and one of his favourite things was, we don't have legal tender. That's right. The Australian currency system's illegal. And so there you are. That's what you get. But the only thing that worked with him was just sit there and listen to him and goodbye. Now, no, you know, that's not very helpful when you've got a busy list, as I know you people have. This, in fact, was an application for an individual declared a vexatious litigant. So we'd got to that point in the Supreme Court. But, so I had enough time for him to hang himself, really. But
so what did you decide? Anyway,
he was vexatious. So he was declared vexatious in Victoria, and then he moved. Then he started litigating in the federal court. Actually, it's a bit of an example, if you've got the time, of that particular. I had a fair bit to do with him. He started off with really a meritorious complaint. He was employed in an engineering factory, I think, and he suffered some knee injury, which he definitely had a knee injury, no doubt about that. And it was probably fairly unpleasant for him. He then litigated in the county court, and he got what he considered to be a pretty poor result. He got a verdict, I've forgotten now, $50,000 or something. But he thought it was, very unfair. So up until that point, his behaviour, so far as anyone could ascertain, was reasonable. But then he sued his solicitor, then he sued his barrister, then he started suing the doctors who'd given evidence against him, or evidence for him. Then he tried to sue doctors who'd given evidence against him. And this whole thing, and by the time he, you know, I think there were 14 or 15 writs. And by the time he'd got to the end, he was just totally out of control. And the whole thing, I've spoken to Grant Lester about him, actually, and others. Quite often these people start off with, a meritorious or at least an argument that's got some merit, but it turns into lunacy in the end. Anyway, having looked at the general nature of the management of those particular three categories, I'll turn to some specific areas of experience that you've all had, no doubt, in the course of your hearings. The hearings of people with disadvantaged backgrounds, hearings of this nature are more likely to involve, disadvantaged backgrounds and perhaps highly complex behaviours. You'll most likely know the nature of the behaviour you anticipate by reason of the file. I'm assuming that most of you at least get the file sometime before the hearing. And obviously the sort of person I was just talking about a minute ago, the file's, file's that thick, 2 foot thick just about. But you'll have some inkling from the materials of what it is that you're going to get. And a bit of thinking about that when you read the file gives you an opportunity to plan and prepare for the hearing. The file will often reveal a trademark example of the high complex individual, that is volumes of correspondence, misinformed understanding of the tribunal processes, often aggressive notes sent to the registrar and other staff. So that's your warning, and it's your opportunity to think about strategies to manage what may prove to be a difficult hearing if not kept under control. On the other hand, you may not know that the person you're about to deal with in this category is in this category until the hearing starts, but it'll usually become clear in the first 15 minutes or so what high conflict behaviours you might expect in the course of the hearing. And it's at this point that it's of maximum importance to be both flexible and patient. And you might have to restate some of the things that you started at the commencement of the hearing, but patience is the key here. In terms of strategies, we've discussed the strategies of early simple English communications. I can't emphasise that enough, and the identification of issues. We've discussed setting the scene as to who does what and when. This category of litigant may not understand what you've said at the beginning, or equally as likely they'll seek to ignore it and impose themselves in the hearing. I recommend, at least at the start, an accommodating and patient approach. I agree with what Justice Kyo has said in his paper, that aggressive trial management with the high complex individual can result in arguments, time wasting, unscheduled adjournments. Endeavours to control the proceedings with this particular category of litigant by time limits may prove to be of limited utility. Certainly worth a try, but how well it goes, you might end up having an argument at the end of the time period, which will blow out another half hour. Deadlines are usually not met by this particular group of people, and then we have a debate about the issue of whether the deadline was fair or not. But nevertheless, that's not to say you shouldn't, at the commencement of the hearing, at least try and impose some rails on where it's going. It's certainly worth attempting to get some time limits on the length of submissions, even if you may have to vary them as things progress. And I also agree with Justice Kyrie that given the constraints that are imposed by the rules of natural justice, sometimes the most efficient approach to managing a hearing with mentally ill or with the querulant, self-represented person, is to allow them to proceed with as little as necessary intervention as possible, apart from what's necessary to explain processes, to give guidance and occasionally give rules to evidentiary matters. And basically, that's what I did with the particular litigant that I talked about. Sometimes these litigants will engage in personal abuse of you and others, such as the representatives of the respondent, and it's not uncommon for allegations of bias. This does need to be dealt with politely but firmly, but with some empathy for the apparent distress that the litigant is demonstrating. You may have heard of the BIF technique for dealing with personal attacks, hostile statements, and generally bad behaviour from a high-conflict person. It doesn't stand for BIF on the nose, but for brief, informative, friendly and firm. The technique is particularly relevant to occasions when you have to respond to abusive emails or correspondence, and if you're at the head of a section, you might be doing that fairly regularly because these people do tend to engage in voluminous correspondence if they're not happy. So the BIF technique, that is brief, informative enough, friendly but firm. And I consider that each of those words are nevertheless relevant to management of all of the types of individuals that we're discussing in a hearing. Your objective is to calm down the highly complex behaviour of the litigant. And another technique that's referred to in the high conflict resolution literature is what's called the ear technique. That's empathy, attention and respect. And you can show empathy but in a number of ways. You can show empathy by statements. I see this is upsetting you. Would you like to have a short break? I see how important this is to you. I'm trying to understand what it is that you're telling me. I understand this can be frustrated. There are statements that you can make to these litigants which demonstrates your sort of empathy and understanding of the difficulties they're having. You can also demonstrate attention non-verbally by looking at the litigant in the eye maybe sitting forward to show you're listening, or statements such as, I want to understand what you're saying. I can see the point you're trying to make, but I need to understand, you know, where this fits into what it is that's your case. Statements of this nature demonstrate that notwithstanding all the bad behaviour, you're still prepared to treat the litigant with calmness and fairness. You may not feel like treating them with calmness and fairness, but your calmness may well have the effect of calming them down. So stay calm. Don't criticise or admonish or give advice. Your objective is to get the litigant to unconsciously mirror the behaviour you want, and which you should stay calm by you speaking calmly and not losing your temper. There's just one caveat that I want to raise in relation to this. We've got to remember that our hearing rooms are workplaces. So our staff, they're engaged in their workplace, but so are so is the representative of the respondent, and obviously just straight-out abuse can't be tolerated and needs to be corrected, and if need be, just stop the hearing and make it clear to the person that you won't continue to tolerate that behaviour. They can have a think about it for 20 minutes or 15 minutes and then see how you go. But staying calm, speaking quietly, not losing your temper doesn't necessarily mean that the behaviour that affects people such as your staff or other people in the courtroom is to be tolerated. Other strategies that might be employed when things become difficult, as I've said, have a short break. Certainly, and I suppose we've all experienced this, I certainly have, if you feel under pressure yourself, it's wiser to stand down briefly than act impetuously or respond to misconduct on the part of the litigant in an untoward manner. Likewise, it might be a good tactic if things are getting heated to offer to stand the matter down for the litigant and ask them would they like to put what they want to say in bullet points, or, you know, perhaps you'd like to go and read section such and such of the legislation so you can identify what it is you're trying to tell me. Give them an opportunity to consider their options and prepare, in effect, brief oral submissions. None of this is to say that these people, handling these people is easy, but certainly my emphasis upon you control the hearing, you set the tone, at least has got a better chance of getting a good result than others. And I've mentioned contempt. Most certainly the behaviour of some litigants might well amount to contempt in the face of the court. As I've said, be very wary of actually using powers yourself in the course of a hearing. It may well be that I've seen this situation where the conduct certainly justified a charge of contempt, but raise it with the head of jurisdiction, and if need be, the Attorney General can lay a charge. I won't repeat what I said, but I've seen several examples of just grief because the hearing ran off the rails. The judge laid a charge of contempt and then was all pretty difficult. As I say, and as Justice Cairo says in his paper, that's not to say it's not an inappropriate topic to raise with the party and say, well, look, you know, you're getting awfully close to contempt, and I should tell you that, you know, you'd be charged with contempt and the consequences of that, so forth, so forth. I want to turn to the another set of circumstances that you may face, and that's the highly emotional, confrontational and misinformed applicants, but as well as their representatives, their support people and family members. Now, I know in the AAT, it's commonplace, and I suspect it may also be commonplace in WACAT for someone to turn up to help the litigant with their cases. The same issues arise in respect of such persons, that's the helpers, as they do with the highly emotional, confrontational and misinformed applicants. In fact, in some ways, managing those representatives becomes more difficult than dealing with the applicant alone, because you may end up dealing with both an emotional applicant and an emotional representative. And I understand that I haven't had a great deal to do had a lot to do with cases in court where witnesses are giving evidence online, but now I think so many of your hearings are dealing with people, and if they've got somebody sitting in their kitchen who's meant to be their representative sitting there, I understand all the difficulties that can create, and I expect the sort of things I've talked about, the only way of dealing with it, that's trying to lay out guidelines, trying to have the process clearly explained. But I suspect that that is a difficulty which you probably face quite regularly. It's a lot easier to deal with somebody in your hearing room than somebody assisting the applicant in their back bedroom. But I suspect you people know a lot more about that than I do. Nevertheless, that said, the strategies that I've talked about for managing self-represented litigants in person should also be deployed for persons who are seeking to assist the litigant in the hearing before you. And that's you maintain the patient, the calm, quiet approach with them. And, of course, with those people, you'll also have to, and probably a good idea at the start of the hearing when they announce that they're there to assist the applicant, you'll need to point out, well, yes, you're permitted to, but here are the guidelines. No interruptions. Speak when you're spoken, ask to, you know, you get your opportunity, etc. No doubt many of the problems that can develop when emotional and misinformed members of family or other representatives attempt to assist equally emotional litigants in person are known to you. And I suppose the additional problems are with the assistant, the so-called person who's assisting the litigant. They probably don't understand the nature of the hearing. They probably don't understand the history of the application, and they don't understand the relevance of evidence. So you do have difficulties in dealing with these people. And obviously a particular problem, which no doubt you've all experienced, arises when the applicant or the representative interrupts the other in the course of giving evidence, coaches the other. And as I said, I suspect this is all much more different. So much of the work that you're doing nowadays is online or over the telephone or otherwise. Well, I think the only way that you can deal with that is what we've talked about in terms of the hearing with somebody present, that is the drawing of strict boundaries as to the process of giving evidence and presenting arguments and giving a warning that you may endeavour to exclude the person if they're continually interjecting. I understand the sort of difficulties you might have in that regard, but you've got to lay down guidelines, and one of them will be, we'll exclude you, I won't hear you if you're going to behave like this. I'd be interested in knowing whether any of you have got some thoughts about managing that sort of hearing. As I say, it's not something that I've had a lot of experience with, and I think it's really, since the pandemic, become much more likely that you'll be dealing with people online. But I'm interested in any thoughts you might have. I just want to turn briefly to another set of circumstances that I discussed, and that's appropriately managing inexperienced lawyers, advocates, and other representatives. I expect that the appearance of inexperienced lawyers and advocates on behalf of both applicants and respondents before you is commonplace, and I've heard that the AAT has regularly had quite junior solicitors appearing before them. Some agencies may employ in-house advocates whose experience is limited. Well, I think that's you've got to be prepared to deal with. On the one hand, you don't want to crush the enthusiasm of an incompetent junior solicitor, but I think you are entitled to bring them into line, and I think you are entitled to provide such encouragement as you can for them to make their case in a competent way. Beyond that, I don't know what else you can do. I just reiterate that it is a workplace, and I have heard stories of tribunal members on occasions really getting so frustrated with this category of representative that things get out of hand. I haven't really got much more to say about that, except I think you just need to encourage inexperienced people, but at the same time, you can't tolerate bad behaviour. Same thing with them. Just wanted to have a bit of a discussion about reducing complaint fear and dealing with issues of recusal. I consider it's correct to say that complaints made about tribunal members and magistrates who deal with high-volume cases and highly volatile applicants are probably more regularly made than complaints, at least in the courts with which I'm experienced, where generally litigants are represented by highly qualified persons. I suspect that more complaints are made about tribunal members and certainly magistrates with which I'm familiar. And VCAT, in my experience, many, many unfounded complaints were made about tribunal members there. I think we just need to understand that complaints will be made. We have hearings recorded. The recording is going to be your best defence in terms of an unwarranted complaint. A lot of complaints, and I, as president of VCAT, I read every complaint that came in the door. A lot of complaints were really I lost, and that's they're easy to deal with. The more difficult ones are allegations of bias and so forth. But I must say, looking at the transcript, as I would do regularly, or even listening to the tape, very few of these complaints had substance. So basically, my advice to members of tribunals and magistrates court is, look, you've got the tape, you will have behaved properly, don't lose sleep about it. This does raise the issue of recusal. I know it's not unknown for somebody to make a complaint at one stage of a hearing and then on the latter say, you know, you should stand down. I think we all have to remember there's a principle of necessity. Cases have to be heard. We have to get through them. And I think we know what the High Court said about recusal. It's only in the circumstance that a properly informed observer would have reason to think there might be bias. Well, that's a pretty high bar. And most of the complaints that I saw about members didn't get anywhere near that bar. So I know it's hurtful when complaints are made, but I think it's part of the business. And as I say, I think if you've got a recording, you know what's happened, you've behaved properly, there's no reason to be concerned about it. And turning to recusal, I'd be very reluctant to recuse yourself on the basis of somebody complaining about bias. Let them deal with it if they think there's any substance, and usually there won't be. I think generally the time's pretty well gone. I hope some of those thoughts are useful. I think really in the end, what I've had to say over about an hour can be summarised pretty easily. Have a structure. You set the tone. Stay calm. And in general, if you've prepared for the sort of difficulty you might face beforehand, or if you realise you're in trouble when the proceeding starts, be flexible and make sure you establish firm guidelines. And in general, try and keep the parties into those guidelines. And I think that's about really all I can help you with at the moment this evening.
Thank you.
Does anyone want to make any comments or any... their own experience dealing with these sort of people. Because, and I haven't said it, but one of the things that I think is really important in bodies like the AAT is the collegiate structure you have. And I can tell you, there are plenty of times when I left the bench when something untoward had happened in front of me and I didn't quite know how to handle it. I had no problem saying, look, I'm just going to stand down for a minute and find someone in the next door room to chat it through. I think discussing these things with your peers, so many of them have experienced the same issues. Don't suffer, you know, if you are distressed about something that's happening in your court, don't suffer it by yourself. Share it with others and you'll generally find an answer and you'll find good advice around, you know, the areas where you work with your other members. Mm.
Thank you, Murray, and show your appreciation, everyone, please. Some of the points that you made, Murray, have reminded me of a few things, and one of them is the advocate aspect that you've raised, where in the AAT you can not only have representatives coming along, but people who may be advocates. And one of the dangers, and I suppose others have experienced it, is where the advocates are from organisations that, in our case, advocate for particular disabilities. And so they effectively treat that particular applicant as a symbol of a cause, and they lose sight of the fact that they're supposed to be advocating for a particular person on the merits rather than advocating for their cause. And sometimes I've found also that with the querulous, they'll bring in a friend or a supporter as their advocate and then hide behind them and use them as the foil for whatever their other agenda is. It's often, I thought, found easy, helpful to ask the advocate, what do you think your role is, in order that you understand what they think that they are there for, and it makes it quite plain to the applicant just what the boundaries are as well. But you're quite right about the recusals. There's one thing to be told that you have a conflict of interest that can be pretty demonstrable, but the bias one is always vague and intended to be vague. It's intended to throw the tribunal off its stride and to show that the applicant has control over the tribunal member. And if you're too ready to, because it's a difficult case, to abandon it in favour of someone else taking it over, you're effectively admitting that you aren't able to act professionally in respect of the matter before you, and that they've won by discombobulating you. But that's my opinion anyway. If anyone else has any views or questions, please take the opportunity to ask. Funny experiences? Okay, I'll just add one more. In the course of my position, I've had to deal with something like over 35 complaints against members. I've listened to an awful lot of recordings and watched them, and I haven't found any of them to be substantiated. And in fact, in the cases where the people have complained the most, it's not only just about I lost, but they deliberately or misinterpret what is being done by the member, and the member is bent over backwards to be reasonable in the face of very unreasonable behaviour. If you're confident that whoever's dealing with the complaints is going to back you up rather than take the easy way out, you'll be more confident in the way that you manage the people before you. And with the particular difficult characters that we wound up with, part of that is them wanting to control you and show that they're in charge. By taking the easy way out and saying, this is too much like hard work, let someone else do it, yeah, all right, I'll recuse myself, you're effectively telling them that they've won that war of wills and wits.
Anything else?
Oh, I agree with that, Michael. I've already said it. I think I'm just thinking about the sort of complaints that I dealt with as president of VCAT. Likewise, I'd drive down to Friday night, was going down to the holiday house. I'd listen to tapes in that car. I can't think of and the numbers, the numbers would be 10 or 20, 10 or 15 a week. I think I had basically a registrar sort out those that were just saying, I lost and I don't like it. But if there was a complaint actually made against a member, I listened to it. And I can't recall one that I regarded as so serious it should be raised with the member. I can recall on a few occasions discussing with a member, do you think you might have... You didn't do anything wrong, but you think you might have managed it perhaps a different way. But I think, members ought to be pretty confident that the heads of tribunals are going to support them. But they should also be pretty confident that if they sort of follow the sort of structures I've talked about, calmness, dealing with people fairly, no complaint's going to be upheld. And certainly biased complaints are... will never get upheld, I don't think, unless it's something so obvious on the face of it. So I'd urge members not to be too concerned about looking over their shoulder. Just hear the case, run it the way you should run it, and you're going to be safe.
It's an occupational hazard, I think.
Yeah. All right.
Well, I hope some of that's
useful.
Well, thank you very much, Murray. And
okay, Michael.
You may now, with our blessing, withdraw and enjoy what's left of your evening.
You've got some couple of bottles of wine down the back there. All right. Good luck with that.
Thanks very much. And all the best to you.
It's almost bedtime here.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Before everyone else signs off, I was meant to remind people about the Christmas party. 25th of November, is it?
22nd.
Like I said,
Friday the 22nd.
22nd of November. Where's it going to be held?
Here at the South.
22nd of November. Here.
22nd. Yep.
This floor.
Level, probably on the mezzanine.
Mezzanine.
Or maybe here. We don't know yet.
All right. Everyone knows.